We would like to take a moment to thank our sponsor, Preborn. When a mother meets her baby on an ultrasound and hears their heartbeat, it's a divine connection, and the majority of the time, she will choose life. But she can't do it without our help. Preborn needs us, the pro-life community, to come alongside her. One ultrasound is just $28. To donate, dial #250 and say the keyword baby, or visit preborn.com.
Jenna Ellis in the Morning on American Family Radio.
I love talking about the things of God because of truth and the biblical worldview.
The U.S. Constitution obligates our government to preserve and protect the rights that our founders recognize come from God, our Creator, not our government. I believe that Scripture in the Bible is very clear that God is the one that raised up each of you, and God has allowed us to be brought here to this specific moment in time.
This is Jenna Ellis in the Morning.
Good morning. Good morning. Well, we are starting in the state of Tennessee. It is Tuesday, February 4th, and Tennessee lawmakers just passed a $447 million school choice bill. This coming from the Tennessean, and they say here's what it does. Tennessee lawmakers held a special legislative session the week of January 27th, and unlike here in the state of Florida, they're actually accomplishing conservative priorities. I mean, imagine that, and sending a significant wins to their governor. House and Senate Republicans on Thursday of last week passed this statewide school choice program. So it expands school choice throughout the state, offering state-funded scholarships for children to attend private schools without regard to their income or zip code. This is being heralded as a win for Tennessee Governor Bill Lee, since on the campaign trail, he wanted to prioritize school choice. And this comes, I'm sure, as welcome news for our first guest, Corey DeAngelis, who is a senior fellow at the American Culture Project. And as he says in his X bio, you can follow him at DeAngelis. Corey. He's a school choice evangelist, and I love that title for him, because that's literally what you are. I think you're at the forefront, Corey, of pushing for school choice and that dollars fund students, not just public institutions. So how big of a win is this for Tennessee?
It's a huge win. I mean, this makes Tennessee the 13th state to go all in on school choice, passing a universal school choice program, which means it's available to everyone. There's no more picking winners and losers. It's regardless of background, zip code, or income, you qualify for the funding to take your kid to the private school of your choosing. Or if you want to go to the public school, it's fine. If you like your public school, you can keep it. But for real this time, unlike with your doctor. But this is because this all happened because the teachers' unions overplayed their hand during the COVID era, showed families what was happening in the classroom via Zoom school or remote learning, and conservatives were upset in particular about the curriculum that wasn't aligned with their values. Now we have 13 states led by Republicans that have passed universal school choice policies. We've advanced school choice more in the past 4 years than in the preceding 4 decades. So it's a big win. And President Trump, before the votes, he sent out a message on Truth Social, basically congratulating the Tennessee legislators for fighting for school choice. This was a number one priority of Governor Bill Lee. And so he's obviously expected to sign it. He actually called a special session to get it done. And each chamber passed it pretty handily. The Senate passed it by a 20-13 vote, only one Republican defection. And in the House, it was a 54-44 vote. So I'm looking at other states to do the same thing this year, including my home state of Texas, which will be the biggest state with universal school choice. If we can get it done, I think we can. The Speaker said he has the votes in the House, and the Senate's easily going to pass the bill, I believe, this coming week or this week.
Oh, wow. That's a great. So in the state of Texas, what bill is that? And do you know when that's exactly coming up in Texas for our listeners there?
Yeah, so we already passed Senate Bill 2 out of our House, out of our Senate Education Committee. It's the number one legislative priority of the Senate. The Senate Bill 1 is the budget. So Senate Bill 2 is the first priority, which is school choice, available all to families. We passed it by a vote of 9-2, all Republicans in favor out of the Education Committee. All Democrats opposed. Both of the Democrats who voted against it, they sent their kids to private school, so total hypocrites on their part. The Senate and the entire Senate body should vote on it, I believe, this week. And it's expected to pass. They pass the bill basically every year. It usually dies in the House. But we had great primary elections where two-thirds of the Republicans who voted against school choice in the House last year, they were ousted, which that's a political earthquake. Incumbents usually win 95% of the time. And now if you just count the votes based on last year's vote, we should have more than enough votes to pass universal school choice in the House as well. We're hoping that that should be done before March, sometime this month. And Governor Abbott listed universal school choice as an emergency item just on Sunday, which means that they can move faster than usual to get this passed. And the Speaker, Dustin Burroughs, who some conservatives weren't happy with him because he got a lot of votes from Democrats to be Speaker, but he voted for school choice last year. He signed a pledge to pass universal school choice, and he was just speaking on a panel a few days ago at Texas Public Policy Foundation, and he indicated that the House does have the votes to pass universal school choice. So I am Excellent. Very optimistic that's going to happen. I'm also looking at states like Wyoming, Idaho, New Hampshire, and North Dakota and South Dakota that are slated to potentially pass universal school choice this year as well. It's a lot of stuff to keep track of, but it's a good problem to have.
Yeah, well, that's why we always turn to you, because you do keep track of all of this. And that's why anyone who is invested in a school choice and all of this reform that frankly should not even be a partisan issue. I mean, this is something that is just logical. And of course, if we took the teachers' unions out of the mix and the politics, I mean, the rationality is just there. But why anyone invested in this should follow Cory DeAngelis on X to see where all of these different battlegrounds are. And this is coming as well, Cory, among a lot of the states, as Donald Trump is really making a push to disband the Department of Education. That was a promise from his first term. We saw that on the campaign trail again. And there were a lot of skeptics, I think, that he would actually get that done, because it seems a little bit like a pipe dream. But over this last week, he's continued to talk about it. And what would that practically look like, and possibly what type of time frame? I mean, I'm hoping he would get this done earlier on in his term so that we have mm-hmm. a kind of a longer runway before 2028.
Yeah, he has a flurry of great executive orders lately, and one of them was on school choice, which directs the Department of Education to use any discretionary funding to promote school choice. So that's puts wind at the sails of the school choice movement. He announced that last week, which was National School Choice Week. And the one that's being talked about most right now is the potential executive order. There's the rumor mill going around that he's going to issue one soon to abolish the Department of Education. And a lot of Wall Street Journal is reporting this, New York Times, Politico, basically everyone now is reporting this, this theory that there's this two-step approach. One, to order the Department of Education to try to reduce its influence on its own, to try to, you know, if you can't kill it all together, maybe give it death by a thousand cuts. So reduce spending in certain areas, get rid of DEI, which he's already done an executive order on that, and they're already taking steps to remove spending on DEI programs, which is a big win already. But also the second part of the plan, which is what a lot of conservatives would really like to see, is to completely nix the department altogether. And, you know, I think everybody basically agrees that you can't just snap your finger and just get rid of the department as through an executive order. There's only so much a president can do. The department was created by an act of Congress. So to get rid of it altogether, the understanding is that you're going to need Congress to vote on a bill to get rid of it. And we have a Republican trifecta. Republicans control both chambers and the president's office at the federal level. So you'd think they'd be able to get it done. But the other stumbling block that's potentially there is a filibuster that can be done in the Senate. I don't think Republicans are going to vote to completely abolish the filibuster. So you might need 60 votes to get rid of the Department of Education in the Senate. Republicans only have 53 seats. They have a majority, but not a supermajority. And so that's a potential stumbling block to consider. Maybe some Democrats come along. I mean, Randy Weingarten, who I don't like for a lot of reasons, she's the head of the teachers union. She fought to keep schools closed as long as possible. She even said on MSNBC after Trump won that her members, quote, don't really care about whether there's a federal Department of Education. She basically just went on to say, we just want the money. But there's a bill in Congress to do that right now where the money that exists doesn't just disappear. It would go back to the states in the form of block grants to use on education. It's Senator Mike Rounds, a Republican out of South Dakota, has the bill called Returning Education to the States Act. And so maybe some Democrats come along. I don't see it happening realistically. But that's basically where everything stands right now. And I think the more realistic thing is that we give it death by a thousand cuts, mm-hmm. that we reduce its influence as much as possible and return the decision-making back to the states. And maybe there's still a way to send that money back to the states through the Department of Education instead of like abolishing it and then giving it to the Treasury and then having them send the money back to the states.
Yeah, the issue with that sometimes, though, is the theory a lot of times, though, is that then even if you do these block grants, then couldn't a future administration just take, or a future Congress, still put strings attached and basically undo that?
That's the potential problem and risk. So you want to get rid of it altogether. So, you know, I totally agree with that approach, I think this bill that Mike Rounds has is a step in the right direction in that, you know, if there's a future administration that's unfavorable, they're going to do that with the current department or they're going to do it under the Treasury either way. So at least this gives us a fighting chance at getting the department out of there. The best way to do it is to not take our money to begin with, to reduce taxation altogether, and then so we don't have to give it back. But the reality today is, you know, that's going to be a more a political lift than, I mean, even just trying to get this bill passed by Mike Rounds is going to be tough as well. So,
yeah, and why don't Democrats ever, you know, come along with Republicans? Because it seems like when Democrats have, you know, even the White House and one chamber, it's like a lot of Republicans end up going along for some reason. I mean, maybe that's part of the uniparty, but it's like, why can't we ever convince any Democrats to actually come along with some of these priorities that, again, should not really be partisan?
Yeah, I mean, that's the nature of partisan politics. They want to vilify the Republicans every time they can, even if it's an idea that they personally like, so that they can use that to campaign against them in the future. So politicians respond to power, not logic, unfortunately, far too often. And when it comes to education, it's really bad because the Democrat Party is a wholly owned subsidiary of the teachers union. All the money that is funneled through the teachers unions for campaigns almost unanimously goes to Democrats. It's about 99.9% of that funding from Randy Weingarten's union goes to the Democrat politicians every single cycle. It's a money laundering operation. It ought to be illegal, but hey, you know, if you have Randy saying we don't really care whether we have a Department of Education or not, maybe there's a fighting chance and maybe we call it on our bluff. But we'll see. And, you know, the timing of this executive order that's rumored by Trump, but the people in Washington circles, they're saying that they don't expect this executive order to come out until Linda McMahon is confirmed, because it would make it trickier if they put out the order and then her trying to get confirmed in front of the Senate, having to deal with all the questions about how that's going to look. I mean, she's probably going to have to deal with those questions.
Yeah, but it would certainly be a lot harder with that executive order and then trying to get confirmed for kind of an agency that's maybe being unwound. But we're already out of time, yes. Corey DeAngelis. I really appreciate your update, and this is really encouraging for school choice. And speaking of, you know, taxpayer funding and all of that, we'll be talking about USAID in the next segment. But it looks like, you know, between Doge, Elon Musk, and others, we're finally getting some accountability for all of this reckless spending that a lot of Americans didn't know specifically what it was going toward, but knew that it was, of course, we know what we pay in taxes, which is just total bloat. And so hopefully there's some auditing and accountability. But thanks so much. And you can follow again at DeAngelis Corey on X. And we'll be right back with more here on Jenna Ellis in the Morning. If we have learned anything from the 2024 election, it's how important it is for us to fight, fight, fight. We also learned how desperately the left wants to fight to take babies' lives, which is why every day Preborn Ministries fights for the babies. Preborn's network of clinics are positioned in the highest abortion areas, fighting for mothers deciding between the life and death of their child. Preborn welcomes these women with God's love and offers them a free ultrasound to introduce their precious baby and hear the beautiful heartbeat. This amazing encounter gives her baby a fighting chance, and the majority of the time, she will choose life. So would you join Preborn in the fight for life? One ultrasound is just $28, and $140 will sponsor 5 ultrasounds. Babies are worth fighting for. To donate, dial #250 on your cell phone and say the keyword baby. That's #250 baby. Or you can visit preborn.com/AFR. That's preborn.com/AFR. All gifts are tax deductible and Preborn has a 4-star charity rating. Fight, fight, fight for the babies.
Welcome back to Jenna Ellis in the Morning on American Family Radio.
Welcome back. Well, last week, President Donald Trump took executive action to freeze the vast majority of all foreign aid payments made through the United States Agency for International Development, or USAID, which that's coming from Town Hall. I think USAID is a little bit more of a misnomer. It's more like an international slush fund. But Town Hall goes on to say Secretary of State Marco Rubio took swift action to comply, quote, consistent with President Trump's executive order on reevaluating and realigning United States foreign aid. Secretary Rubio has paused all U.S. foreign assistance funded by or through the State Department and U.S. Agency for International Development, or USAID, for review. He is initiating a review of all foreign assistance programs to ensure they are efficient and consistent with U.S. foreign policy under the America First agenda. That was a State Department statement that was released about the move. And White House Press Secretary Karoline Leavitt, who is doing a fantastic job, by the way, said this on the waste and abuse in USAID. Cut two.
And here's the reason why Elon Musk and others have been taking a look. Because if you look at the waste and abuse that has run through USAID over the past several years, these are some of the insane priorities that that organization has been spending money on. $1.5 million to advance DEI in Serbia's workplaces, $70,000 for a production of a DEI musical in Ireland, $47,000 for a transgender opera in Colombia, $32,000 for a transgender comic book in Peru. I don't know about you, but as an American taxpayer, I don't want my dollars going towards this, and I know the American people don't either, and that's exactly what Elon Musk has been tasked by President Trump to do, to get the fraud, waste, and abuse out of our federal government. Thank you, guys.
Yeah, keep going. That absolutely speaks for me as a taxpayer. But meanwhile, the Democrats are utterly panicking over the fact that maybe light is now being shed on the deep and deepest recesses of the swamp. This is Chuck Schumer on the Senate floor.
We also know this is just the beginning. If DOGE attacks USAID today, then you can be sure they'll move on to another target tomorrow. Who knows? Maybe it'll be the Postal Service or the IRS or even the Social Security Administration. They could be next. Or maybe our national security agencies.
Well, let's welcome in Paul Teller, who is the Executive Vice President of Advancing American Freedom and also served in the White House during President Trump's first term. And Paul, good morning. And, you know, I don't know about you, but I think everything, every agency that Schumer just mentioned, other than like the post office, I'm actually fine with DOGE eliminating or significantly reducing.
Good morning, Jenna. First of all, thanks for having me. Just listening to your last couple of segments. My blood is boiling. My heart is pumping. This is a great way to start the day. Really great to be with you. And you're exactly right. I love how Senator Schumer is reading that list as if those are negatives, right? And I'm thinking Joe America from sea to shining sea would hear that list and be like, yeah, well, we should either shut some of those things down, revisit, trim, eliminate, reform, all of those things. So just absolutely hilarious that he doesn't see the irony in his own words.
Right. I mean, he's sitting there thinking this is going to resonate with the American people that, oh, my gosh, you guys, we might eliminate the IRS. And we're sitting there going, yeah, like, you don't have to sell me on it further, Chuck Schumer. Like.
Yeah, right. And like any of that, anyone in that list, like, is anybody happy? Like, anyone getting a Social Security check, is he or she happy with the Social Security Administration? I mean, like, he's like naming agencies that nobody's happy with, and even national security agencies. The notion that we can't root out waste, efficiency, people who are using the power of the state to go after, you know, personal enemies, political enemies. I mean, that's crazy. Everyone would say that those are legitimate things. So, yeah, it's just great. Give us more, Senator Schumer. It's fantastic.
Yeah, absolutely. So, you know, so you were very high up in policy in Trump's first term, and you're seeing now what's happened in just the first 2 weeks of his second term. What do you see as different, or perhaps I think it's just so accelerated in the second term. How would you characterize kind of the contrast since you were up front and center for the first time around?
Yeah, you're exactly right. So much advanced preparation, acceleration. And that's really to the tribute of just all folks related to the White House, the campaign, et cetera, who just said, unlike in 2016 when we were kind of caught by surprise, like, oh, my gosh, Hillary Clinton didn't win, didn't have a lot of things ready to go. This time it was like, we're going to assume we're going to win and we're going to have things ready to go. So, boom, that's why you just saw, you know, the last couple of weeks of just things just flying out the door, executive orders, just, you know, negotiations with foreign leaders, you name it. So you're right. That's been a huge, huge difference. And I think another big difference, too, is certainly in the first term, President Trump, Vice President Pence, did their best to keep all campaign promises, you know, and obviously Congress thwarted them in certain cases, but, you know, we can get into that another time. You know, this time it's just like, there's not even a sense of wanting to wait. It's like, we're just going down the list of all these campaign promises and just firing on all cylinders. And it's just really, really fantastic.
It is. And it seems like the multitasking that's happening right now is just phenomenal. Like the media, as I've been saying for the last 2 weeks, can't even keep up, which is fantastic because then they can't go in and nitpick and criticize every little thing. It's like they don't even know where to direct their attention. So I'm speaking with Paul Teller, and you can follow him at P Teller. Yes, he actually joined X. For those of us who've known, who've known Paul for a while, you're finally kind of coming out of the shadows, man. And I love it.
Yeah. I know.
It's great.
I love it. One other point to make Jenna, is that what I think also is different this time than the last time is we have some like cultural power behind us this time. What I mean by that is, for example, the biggest example, Elon Musk, right? All he needs to do is one tweet against, you know, a congressman or some other government staffer saying, you know, this person doesn't want to cut XYZ, and boom, you know, like there'd just be so much weight and pressure put on that elected official or other government, you know, official. We didn't really have that last time, right? There were those of us proposing spending cuts, and most people were out there either yawning or is it really important? There wasn't any like cultural backup. Now we have it, and it's just super exciting. Mm-hmm. I think it's going to be successful.
That's a really excellent point, because in the first term, Trump was almost himself, at least forward-facing, just the tip of the spear. And now it seems like there is a much wider bench of serious influencers and serious backing with someone like an Elon Musk. And then also a lot of these red state governors that instead of kind of, you know, sitting on their piety over in Rhino land, they're actually recognizing that they need to get some conservative priorities done. And so what should, in your view, Paul Teller, be the conservative priorities for this term? I mean, I think we could go on with a laundry list since we're going to get more than just one or two done. But what would be the measure of success for Trump's second term?
Yeah, great question. I mean, first of all, let's face it. Some of it, we can already check the success boxes, right? Some of the cultural fights he's waged at the border, with international so-called allies, et cetera, et cetera. But yeah, from the kind of conservative movement perspective, I think you just have to look for an overall kind of regression of government from the average person's life, literally a shrinking of government. And I think the two most obvious ways we can measure that, tax reform and spending cuts. And you may say, oh my God, those are two huge, you know, seemingly impossible tasks. But both are really on track to get some significant tax reform, you know, extending the Trump tax cuts from last time and going further. We could talk about that. But then also through this process, many of your listeners may have heard about reconciliation, which is the fancy Washington word for let's get something through the Senate faster without needing 60 votes. You just need 51 votes. So using reconciliation as a way to get tax reform through, you could also tack on spending cuts. And that's the plan. It's kind of in one package, maybe two packages. We'll see how it works to get through Congress. The ability for the average person to keep more of his or her own money in, you know, in his or her own pocket, and really slashing government. And that's the thing. Because of this cultural backing that we now have, it seems like we're going to be able to cut real spending, not just a million here, 2 million there, a wasteful program here or there. We now should be talking in the hundreds of billions, maybe even the trillions if you're looking out over a few years. So I would say those are kind of the two big measures of success coming up this year.
Yeah, and I think that was so brilliantly described, which is getting the government out of the average American's life as much as possible. I mean, that is what government should do, is just make sure everything is efficient so that we can go and independently make our own choices, pursue the American dream. I mean, life, liberty, yeah. Pursuit of happiness. That is what America yeah. is all about. And realistically, if income tax was eliminated completely, Dan Bongino actually talked about this on his show. It was maybe yesterday, or I'm not exactly sure which program this week, but I saw a clip of it that I want to get your reaction to, because he talked about how the elimination of income tax, if that actually happened, how much more the economy would boom. And I think even while dealing with inflation and some of that, I mean, if the average person has, you know, between $10,000 and $30,000 extra, I mean, even you know, $2,000. Remember Nancy Pelosi used to say was peanuts? I mean, that's not for the average person. You get an extra $2,000.
That's right.
That's significant. But, you know, when you're talking about tens of thousands, that's even more. So this is what Bongino said on the elimination of income tax.
If Donald Trump can convince the Republican Congress to get rid of the income tax for a system of tariffs instead, ladies and gentlemen, the economy will absolutely explode like you have not seen since the Reagan years, maybe bigger. The explosion of capital and investment in the United States and the basically $30,000 or so raise a lot of people are going to get will absolutely blow our economy up like you've never seen before.
Paul, your thoughts?
Well, you know, it's interesting because you're right. There's a lot of conversation right now in the political class in D.C. and elsewhere talking about how should the government get its money, right? Like, it's got to have some money, certainly for its constitutionally legitimate things like national security, immigration enforcement, some of the other things that are enumerated in the Constitution. The question is how. Obviously, traditionally right now, it's the income tax, some tariffs, some other fees, that kind of thing. Some are even out there reviving the idea of a national sales tax. So in other words, maybe get rid of the income tax, but instead of putting tariffs in, have, you know, tax on consumption. A lot of folks talking about that. So that those conversations are going on. I would say, you know, for us here at Advancing American Freedom, we're more in the camp of don't do across the board tariffs, do targeted tariffs like Trump has been doing these last couple of weeks as part of a negotiation, as part of a threat to adversaries or even to allies who are treating us poorly, you know, so-called allies, things like that. But overall, I think we're saying, tariffs are unfortunately too prone to kind of earmarking, meaning, you know, they would be different rates for different products for different companies at different times. And there's just too much kind of government interference in that instead of just kind of simple, low, flat rates across the board for, you know, income or possibly consumption, some folks say. So for us, we're in that camp, but it's exciting to have those conversations. And, you know, and even looking at the transition to any new tax system, there's problems there too. So I think for at least the near term, we're keeping the income tax system. So while we're keeping that, can we keep it as simple as possible, get rid of, you know, tax expenditures, you know, favorite corporate benefits or benefits to certain industries, certain preferred behavior from the government, get rid of those as much as we can and just lower the rate to incentivize investment in America, manufacturing in America, and like you said, just having the average American keep more of his or her own money to make more of his or her own choices. So
it's
good times ahead.
It is, and it's really exciting, as you mentioned, Paul Teller, and listeners can follow him on X. I'd encourage you to do so, at P. Teller. It's exciting to even just have these conversations. As you were talking, I was remembering back in high school, I was the nerd that loved debate, and but hey, it got me where I am today probably. But I remember back, this was like 1998, and our resolution was abolish income tax in favor of an alternative. And at that point, it was like, this is purely theoretical. This is just, you know, for you high schoolers to learn how to figure out policy plans and all that kind of stuff. But it's like, fast forward now, and we're actually realistically talking about this. It really is exciting. But before we let you go, Paul Teller, I also wanted to get your comments on the Trump Netanyahu meeting. CNN's headline is, "It's a consequential moment for both leaders and for the Middle East." So Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu's arrival as the first foreign leader to pay President Donald Trump a visit since he returned to the White House comes at a consequential moment. And there's been a lot of chatter as well about, with USAID and whether or not we're pausing aid to Israel, and people who are very pro-Israel are concerned about that. I don't think that anybody's advocating for that. It's just, it's more that we want to make sure that what we're spending on actually advances American priorities. But what do you see coming out of this meeting and sort of setting the stage for the overall foreign policy view?
Yeah, absolutely. And first of all, you make a great point that just the fact that this is President Trump's first, in-person meeting with any foreign leader in his second term, I mean, that's not a coincidence, right? That's not by accident. It's not because the schedules happen to work that way. I mean, that was a deliberate plan. The two men like each other, Trump and Netanyahu, very much, have a great trust, great working relationship. President Trump has always loved Israel. Those who doubt that just need to look, at so much evidence from the first term, and now already from the second term, there's already great evidence. But I think what would be great to come out of it is, basically an agreement that America is going to stop doing what it did under Biden-Harris, i.e. stop trying to rein in Israel, stop publicly criticizing it, just the opposite, kind of letting it go and saying, look, you're our friend, you're our ally, we're with you, you do what you need to do. And if Hamas is breaking the hostage deal and you need to tweak it and attack this or rein in that, great, go ahead and do it. And same with Hezbollah in Lebanon, and we're going to help you tackle, the head of the octopus or the snake or whatever the analogy is, Iran, right? We're going to keep sanctioning them. We're going to make sure that any attack that comes at Israel or any American allies gets retaliated against without hesitation. And then, frankly, I think a big thing that'll come out of this is taking the next steps to expanding the Abraham Accords, those peace agreements that President Trump and his administration negotiated last time. Saudi Arabia looks like it's very anxious to have a normalization agreement with Israel. I think it needs a little more calm to come first in Gaza before they could, tolerate that domestically in Saudi Arabia. But that's coming. And that's just really great news. Peace with friends, peace in the Middle East, and treating our enemies like actual enemies. I think that's just going to be a fantastic meeting, a series of meetings this week.
Yeah, that will be fantastic. And real quickly as well, your thoughts on, as Trump is looking at the ceasefire and all of that going on in the Middle East, what about his promise on ending the war in Ukraine?
Yeah, see, that's a little trickier, right? Because I think he doesn't want it to end just for the sake of ending, meaning he wants it to end with the good guys not being defeated and not being left where they are. In other words, the Russians pushed Ukrainians back, deep into territory that Russia has no business taking, killed so many Ukrainian civilians. So I think the question is, how do you end it with dignity, with some return of Ukrainian land and other such things? So that seems to me a little more complex than what we're talking about, but maybe not. Maybe they're just different complexities. But the good news is he's talking peace. He's talking from a position of strength, not just pretty please, will you please stop fighting, right, like the previous administration, but actually from a position of American strength. And it's going to be a great 4 years.
Yeah. And I haven't seen him once just, you know, standing, staring vacant with an ice cream cone in his hand. So already that is a huge
exactly.
level up. So Paul Teller, really appreciate your time this morning. He's the Executive Vice President for Advancing American Freedom. You can follow him on X at P Teller. And Paul Teller is just such a wealth of information, and really appreciate you and look forward to having you back on soon. And we'll be talking more about the overall foreign policy strategy and the tariffs and all of that with our next guest from the National Taxpayers Union when we come right back with more here on Jenna Ellis in the Morning.
Welcome back to Jenna Ellis in the Morning on American Family Radio.
Welcome back. Well, let's talk more about these tariffs and the actual impact on American consumers. So this coming from the Washington Post, in a dramatic last-minute move, the Trump administration agreed Monday to pause sweeping tariffs on Mexico for a month while the two sides hammer out an agreement on security and trade. The U.S. and Mexican leaders announced. The president of Mexico said on X that in a, quote, good conversation with President Trump, Mexico is committed to rushing 10,000 National Guard troops to its border to try to block the flow of drugs into the United States, especially fentanyl. The United States pledged to work to avoid the illegal trafficking of weapons to Mexico, she said, and Trump confirmed the agreement, saying in a post on his Truth Social platform that the deployment of Mexican troops, quote, will be specifically designated to stop the flow of fentanyl and illegal migrants into our country. So for more on this, let's go to Brandon Arnold, who is the Executive VP at the National Taxpayers Union. So Brandon, overall, there's been some mixed reactions on tariffs. I know you were listening to our good friend Paul Teller in the last segment talking about, you know, maybe some complications on that. What's your assessment?
Yeah, well, first of all, thanks for having me on the show. And please don't have me on after Paul Teller anymore. He's just going to make me look bad. But yeah, listen,
he knows too much.
He does. I just texted him after the show. He's a great guy. Great guest. I am no fan of tariffs. Listen, I don't think tariffs achieve their strategic goals. I don't think they tend to benefit people, especially lower income people, at all, whether we're talking about domestically or against on the countries that we apply the tariffs against. It hurts both sides. Now, I know Trump is using these primarily as a negotiating tool. And obviously, we have enormous problems, particularly at our southern border with drug cartels, the inflow of drugs, illegal immigration, and so forth. So if it's merely a negotiating tool, you know, that may serve some positive ends here. But it goes back to the old gambling analogy. You know, I'm not a big gambler, but you never put money on the table that you're not prepared to lose. When you're engaged in these types of negotiations, you should never make a threat that you're not prepared to carry out. And in this case, if this threat was fully carried out in terms of tariffs on the Chinese tariffs, obviously, which already did take effect just today, as well as Mexico and Canada, which are paused for a month, you know, you'd be looking at a tax increase on Americans of over $1 trillion. That'd be the largest tax increase since World War II. And where I'm from, tax increases do not generate growth. They do not create wealth. They do not make us a more free or prosperous nation, quite the opposite. So that is my concern here, that these tariffs, if they ever were fully implemented, maybe they will be, maybe they won't, but they would hurt a lot of Americans. They'd hurt our manufacturing sector, our farmers, and they'd hurt everyday Americans who put Donald Trump in office largely to reduce prices because we've lived through 4 years of inflation, a disaster under Biden.
Yeah, and certainly I don't think any Americans want taxes to increase. In fact, we all, myself included, are hoping that the income tax significantly goes down. There's reform at the IRS. There's some other method of figuring out a lot of the bloated waste and spending, perhaps with DOGE. So it seems like these are two competing interests here to impose tariffs that, as you've described it, tariffflation, right, which I think is an apt term. But then also Trump is promising to reduce income tax and give Americans more back more than has been taxed and more of their earned wealth. So how are these two competing interests going to coexist if this is just a negotiation tactic? Maybe it's not.
Yeah, I mean, I think you framed it very, very nicely. And that is a lot of the work that he's doing on the tax front, on the regulatory front, reducing spending, the work of DOGE and Elon Musk and others, that's all fantastic. And we're really supportive of the tax effort. We were back in 2017 when we got the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act across the finish line. That was enormous. And we saw a tremendous amount of growth in our economy. Jobs were created. Inflation remained low. Wages went up. Critically important, wages went up. So people actually had more money in their pocket as well as lower taxes. All of those positive things happened, 2018, 2019, up until the onset of the pandemic. We need to get back to that point because so much of these tax cuts are expiring at the end of this year. So that's a critical portion of his agenda, as is the deregulatory stuff, making sure that we can actually build the infrastructure that our economy needs. We're not having, 10 years of environmental review to build a road or a pipeline or what have you. That's all nonsense. But yeah, if you combine all those positives with what could be, a tariff strategy that, according to the Tax Foundation, would kill 300,000 jobs domestically alone, you're kind of at odds with one another. And the fact is, when you just kind of look at the political landscape, we're dealing with incredibly narrow majorities in both the House and Senate, particularly the House, of course. And if Donald Trump imposes these tariffs and is forced to lose political capital because people are seeing higher prices, and even while Trump's base will probably stay with him, a lot of people would get frustrated, maybe not be as supportive of Trump as they are, and that honeymoon period may come to an end. It's going to be a lot more difficult to get his priorities through Congress, through a tightly divided Congress, if Trump isn't able to call recalcitrant members and say, hey, I'm a popular president. I have this mandate. Vote for this bill because we need it. Our country needs it. He's going to lose some of that ability if he takes a hit politically with these big tariffs. That's what makes me worry.
I'm speaking with Brandon Arnold, who is the executive VP at the National Taxpayers Union. And what about the factor of returning a lot of our manufacturing here to America? And that was a huge emphasis in Trump's first term. Of course, the renegotiated NAFTA agreement that became the USMCA. And then there were a lot of different trips talking about manufacturing being brought. I mean, I was with President Trump at the time on, some of those trips in Michigan and, other places. Is that potentially maybe in Trump's mind, at least, an offset? Setting factor for tariffs that would be an encouragement to just have our manufacturing done here so then companies don't even have to deal with something like a tariff?
Yeah, I mean, I think tariffs can bring some manufacturing jobs back. I think the most powerful force to bringing manufacturing back, and incidentally, our manufacturing sector is pretty strong. We've downsized in terms of the workforce, which is unfortunate for a lot of communities. But we've increased efficiency due to technological upgrades, utilization of AI, and just other efficiencies that our output has increased. Our manufacturing sector is pretty strong. The best thing that we can do for manufacturing is to lower our tax burden, as we did in 2017, dropping that corporate rate all the way from 35 down to 21%, and then providing proper tax incentives for investing in this country, technical policy, but bonus depreciation and so forth, R&D incentives, so people are innovating here in this country. All of those things act like a magnet to grow manufacturing, to encourage investment, and that's exactly what happened in 2018 and 2019. Again, those provisions, some of them, with the exception of the corporate rate, are expiring. We need to get those back on the books. And then, there are literally billions of potential customers outside of the borders of the United States. We want manufacturing to be strong, not just so they can supply our citizens with low-cost, high-quality goods, but also so we can sell that stuff all over the world. And we've done that. We've exported billions and billions of dollars in technology and in IP and so forth. So we want to make sure we have access to those markets. And unfortunately, when you get into these tit-for-tat tariff wars, we're seeing this with China. We're getting threats from the EU, threats from China, threats from Mexico. We can close off opportunities to sell things, whether that's bourbon, guitars, agricultural products, you name it, that we make here in the United States. We want to have those markets open for us.
Yeah, all of that really makes sense. And so, you know, if you're advising the Trump administration and, you know, seeing all of these different factors at play, what do you think is the most important priority or just something that, you know, maybe the average listener can keep in mind as they're seeing all of these headlines? And I think there's a lot of faith and trust really that's been earned by Trump, especially in the last 2 weeks. But overall, I mean, he's maintained a 54% approval rating, which is phenomenal. And I think that's only going to increase as his second term continues. But what would be, you know, kind of the main advice to the administration to kind of keep all of these things, I mean, all of these spinning plates at once and keep this on track?
Yeah, I mean, I think the first thing is stating that the United States is open for business again. We saw the Biden administration raise taxes on our business community, regulate our business community, go after them with lawsuits from the FTC and other government agencies, the CFPB, all of these alphabet soup of agencies, created a hostile environment for our American companies. We need to be supportive. We need to encourage foreign direct investment, making sure that other countries have the incentive to open up manufacturing plants here in the United States. And then we need to knock on doors across the country and say, hey, you need to be open, an open marketplace for American goods, and you need to give American goods and services an equal and level playing field in your country so that we can sell into the European Union, into Australia, into Asia, and what have you. And so we can bring some stuff into this country too. You know, the majority of things that we bring into this country are not consumer goods. They are raw materials and intermediate goods that our manufacturers use to turn into automobiles or airplanes or what have you. So we need to have that flow working, but we need to reestablish the American leadership that we saw certainly under Reagan and previous Republican presidents, showing that we are the global leader and that we are going to set the rules for the road and that America is going to be first.
Yeah. And speaking of the raw materials and, you know, coming in, especially like auto parts and all that, that was a huge point of discussion during the whole USMCA negotiation and all of that, that, you know, Trump was requiring that actually American made would be a percentage of actual materials as well, not just the raw materials. And then it's assembled in the United States and they call it American made. Was any of that rolled back during the Biden administration, to your knowledge, that Trump is going to have to kind of reestablish, or where are we at with some of those wins from his first term?
Yeah, the USMCA wasn't rolled back as much, but what happened, you know, one of the interesting things that happened during the Biden administration, the electric vehicles, the EV tax credit, which was supposed to be a domestic incentive, only apply, that $7,500 credit for EVs only apply to countries that met certain requirements, including having American components, sufficient American components. Biden completely eviscerated that, much to the chagrin of former Senator Joe Manchin, by saying, well, if you purchase a car, then all of those requirements are in place, including having a battery that doesn't come from China and so forth. But if you lease the car, then it doesn't matter. You can bring it, the parts can come from anywhere. We don't care. The lease completely doesn't end around all of these requirements. And what have we seen? The lease rate for EVs has absolutely skyrocketed. People are leasing EVs at a rate double what they were prior to this this stupid law kicking in. And so people respond to government policies. It seems so obvious, yet government never gets this. So, yeah, if we're going to have rules of the road, then they need to be fair. They need to be even-handed. In the case of, you know, Mexico and Canada, when you're making a car, the car and certainly the parts can cross the border multiple times during the production. So each time they cross, they could be facing an additional tariff. That's how you could have this exponential increase in tariffs if these do kick in, which certainly makes me nervous, because the last thing people need is higher priced automobiles. If you purchased a car over the past 5 or so years, you realize that that market is really out of whack and really tough on Americans.
Yeah, well said. I think the last thing that Americans need is higher priced anything right now. So really good word. Brandon Arnold, thanks so much. We are already out of time. And I've loved doing more of a deep dive into, you know, some of these different policy segments with both you and Paul Teller. Really appreciate it. You can always reach me and my team, Jenna, at AFR.net.
We'd like to thank our sponsors, including Preborn. Preborn has rescued over 200,000 babies from abortion, and every day their network clinics rescue 200 babies' lives. Will you join Preborn in loving and supporting young moms in crisis? Save a life today. Go to preborn.com.